On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. We've talked about the Negro Motorist Green Book on the show before. It was considered the Bible of Black travel, a guide that let African Americans know safe places to stop on the road during Jim Crow. There were more than 220 Green Book sites in L.A. alone, from restaurants and hotels to taverns and chicken shacks. Cultural documentarian Candace Taylor is documenting them all. She took our supervising producer, Abby Fentress Swanson, to one that's still standing in South L.A.
How's everybody?
How are you doing?
Okay. Old man, I'm doing all right.
The Dunbar was built in 1928 by a man named John Alexander Somerville. And he was a Black dentist who was just tired of being thrown out of places because he was Black. So he built this. It was called the Somerville Hotel at the time. For this to be around since 1928, it was such a fabulous Spanish colonial building, beautiful architecture. Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington stayed here, Sarah Vaughan. There was an adjoining beauty shop and a liquor store that was also listed in the Green Book. That space next to us is going to be a restaurant that's opening up in 2017. But it was also one of the first hotels in America built expressly for Black people. Right down the street, Club Alabama was also a Green Book listing, and that's where Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington would go for after hours. That place was open from like midnight to 6 a.m. Jack's Chicken Basket, the Chicken Shack was down the street. And they've kept it active, and it's such a great use for it, you know, for low-income housing, for seniors. Just really nice. And we're in South Central, so just remember that, don't believe what you read in the papers.
Hi, Candace, how are you?
Hi, well.
Another Green Book site here in L.A. is the infamous Clifton's Cafeteria downtown. For people who may not know it, describe Clifton's and tell us why it was so important for the Black community back in the day.
Well, Clifton's was a special place, and it still is. You know, it's a five-story cafeteria, first of all, so that's unique in and of itself. It was owned by a man named Clifford Clinton, who was an incredible humanitarian, and he was a Christian in the real sense of the word. You know, he had seen abject poverty. He had traveled to China as missionary with his parents. He just could not accept that a country this wealthy as America would have people hungry. So when he opened up his restaurant, he swore he would feed everybody, regardless of whether they were able to pay. And that's what made Clifton's very different. Right on the menu, it said, pay what you wish, dine unless delighted. He sold so many 5-cent meals and gave away free meals. It was a Depression-era restaurant, and it was listed in the Green Book. So he opened it up and integrated the space.
And at the time, was it one of the few integrated restaurants in Los Angeles?
Well, Los Angeles was a unique place. When you look at America at that time and you see that, you know, the South had its Jim Crow laws and people assumed that the rest of the country was liberal, or especially the West. You know, in California, we think, oh, we're so liberal out here. But the truth was, segregation was in full force throughout the country. And it was even more confusing and even more dangerous to leave the South if you were Black and just travel West, because you didn't know where you were welcome or not, because there were no signs. There weren't as many signs. There was segregation in Arizona. Segregation was legal in New Mexico. But again, it was spotty. So once you got to California, unless you were in an area like South Central where there was a predominantly Black culture and businesses, once you left that area, it was spotty. You didn't know. And that's why the Green Book was still really critical, even in places like downtown Los Angeles.
Now, I understand that you're trying to document every Green Book site on Route 66. Why?
Well, I'm actually looking to document Green Book sites throughout the country. I started on Route 66 because I developed a partnership with the National Park Service, and I was writing a book on Route 66. It was a travel guide, and I was just struck at how little had been written about the route in terms of its earlier days. It started in 1926. A lot of the things we read and learn about Route 66 is that heyday, 1950s, quote-unquote good old days of the white suburban families who jump in their Airstream trailers. And being a Black woman myself, I thought there's got to be more to this story. And I was just tired of 99% of all the people who've written books about Route 66 are white males. I felt like there's got to be a different angle here. And I wondered, where were the Black people who drove Route 66? And then I learned about the Green Book. I reached out to the National Park Service because they have a Route 66 corridor preservation program. And the director there, Kaisa Berthuli, was just really loved my work. I loved what they were doing. And she said, we'd love for you to document some of these sites.
Does L.A. have more preserved sites from the Green Book than a lot of other cities?
Not particularly more than other cities. New York has a densest concentration of Green Book sites because Victor H. Green, who created the Green Book, was a postal worker. He was from New York. And the first Green Book was published in 1936. And he felt like, even in New York, I need to figure out where we can go that's comfortable. And so he started it. It was inspired by Jewish travel guides in the 30s that were being developed for the Borscht Belt. So that's where it started. There's 350 Green Book sites just in the boroughs of Harlem, the Bronx, and Brooklyn. LA has a lot, over like 224. You know, Denver has like over 80. Chicago has a lot. It just depends on where you go. But the whole state of Nebraska has like 20.
Wow. What's the most unusual site that you found?
Oh, it's hard to say. But there is one that stands out in my mind. In Victorville, California, there's a site called Murray's Dude Ranch. And it was quite special. It was billed as the only Negro dude ranch in America. You know, Pearl Bailey bought it in the 50s, and she ran it for a while. Joe Louis used to come there, and he had his entourage, the boxer. You know, it was on the cover of Ebony magazine. It was well known. And when you look at these photographs of these Black men in cowboy hats and, you know, a lot of kids, it was one of the first places where there was integration between Black and white children playing in recreational spaces. This was unheard of. You know, this was something that throughout the country, Blacks were expressly kept out of recreational sites or pools or any type of place where kids would play together. Even in Pasadena, there was a pool that was segregated. They had International Day, quote unquote, and it was the last day before they would clean the pool. So it was when the pool was the most dirtiest was when Blacks could use it. And then they made sure to tell white people, don't worry, after the Blacks get out, we are going to clean it. This was the reality, you know, that we were dealing with in California. Another thing about Route 66 that's interesting to note in terms of like how I came into this project is because there were sundown towns throughout the United States.
Describe what that means.
Sundown towns were all white communities, and they were all white on purpose. James Loewen is a sociologist out of Harvard who wrote a book called Sundown Towns, and he's estimated that there were over 10,000 of these sundown towns throughout the country. So again, most people assume that segregation and the Jim Crow laws were corralled in the South, but that really wasn't the case. Once you left the South, there were sundown towns, which was largely a Northern phenomenon. And these towns were all white. You could not be in the town if you were Black after 6 p.m. Again, you didn't quite know if you were passing through a sundown town. Some of them had signs that literally just said, nigger, don't let the sun go down on you here. But there were other towns you didn't quite know. Sometimes they would ring a bell at 6 o'clock, and you would know what that meant. Anybody Black who was working in the town would know what that meant, and they knew they had to leave. But if you were driving through, you wouldn't know. And it's estimated that there were 44 out of the 89 counties along Route 66 were sundown towns. So
you had to keep moving along.
You had to have a plan. You had to make sure that when you were driving through, you weren't going to be passing through one of these sundown towns after 6 p.m. You needed the Green Book to figure out where you could stay. Once you even got to a multicultural or, say, more, you know, ethnic place like Albuquerque, where there was a large Latino population and American Indian population, even once you got to Albuquerque on Route 66, out of the 100 motels that lined Central Avenue along Route 66, only about 6 of them accepted black people. Again, if you didn't have that guide, once you were there, you'd be knocking on doors and being turned away. So there was a very real threat to personal safety, and there was also just simple convenience of getting from A to B, specifically on Route 66. And with sundown towns, even once you got out to California, Glendale was a sundown town, Culver City, Burbank were sundown towns. Well into the 60s, Glendale was.
Wow. I want to talk a little bit about conservation. The Dunbar's on the National Register of Historic Places, and Clifton's just got this famous $10 million facelift, so it's not going anywhere soon either. Are there efforts to conserve other Green Book sites that aren't currently being protected?
Well, I'm leading the charge on that because I feel like it's really important. You know, I got a couple of grants in the last year. I got a grant from the Graham Foundation, which was an architecture grant, to specifically look at these buildings, to catalog what condition they were in, to photograph them and document them. And we estimated that less than a quarter are really still standing. And of that quarter, there are so few that are still operating, especially under the same name. So when you find one, you want to make sure people know about it, people know what it is. I've reached out to the city planner here in L.A., Ken Bernstein, and he's been very receptive to acknowledging Green Book sites and putting them on their website, listing them as culturally significant and historically significant places. I got a grant from the California Humanities to capture the stories surrounding these Green Book sites and the people who ran them. So this is a way to really capture that history as well, and to look at even other people who were not Black who owned Green Book sites, like Clifford Clinton, the Biltmore, the Bel Air Hotel in L.A. You know, it's like, what's the story behind that? Why did the Bel Air advertise in the Green Book? So capturing those stories, I think, are really important. So I think in terms of preservation and conservation, it'll be different per state or per city. Getting them on the National Historic Register, I investigated that a little bit. It's way too involved. It's expensive. It's not really serving the people who own these buildings because it puts a burden on them to maintain them.
It seems like it couldn't be more perfectly timed as another way to re-examine our relationship with race and migration, segregation, and integration.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is really an important, I think in terms of civil rights, it's pretty obvious that we're still struggling with this issue, right? And to me, it's always been really important to bring the Green Book out of the past and really have an opportunity to reevaluate our relationship with racial segregation. Because, you know, even though the Green Book was this very practical and innovative solution to a horrific situation, you know, physical mobility getting from A to B was dangerous, could be deadly. So the Green Book was a wonderful, resourceful, innovative solution to that. But today, you know, I would argue that social mobility is just as debilitating and just as deadly. And so it's different, but not so different, right? I mean, I remember being 7 years old as a kid in Texas, being in a car with my mother, and we were driving through Sugar Land, which was an old, right now it's a very exclusive suburb, but at the time it was sugarcane fields. And there were all these black men in the fields chained up. And I remember at 7 years old saying, "Mom, I thought slavery was over. I thought we learned that in school, that slavery was over." And she said, "It is, honey." And I said, "Well, why are all these black men chained up in a field?" And she said, "Well, they're prisoners." And I said, "Well, why are they all black?" And she just couldn't answer. She couldn't explain, I guess, institutional racism to a seven-year-old. But at that age, it was very clear to me that we had a problem, that something was wrong. And now, you know, that was in the 70s when we only had about 300,000 men, you know, incarcerated. Now we have 2.3 million. In terms of what we've done socially in regards to race, in terms of, like I said, social mobility, the neighborhoods that most of these Green Book sites are located in, because they tend to be clustered in what were traditional African-American neighborhoods, like South Central, like Harlem, you know, in Chicago, the Bronzeville District, south side of Chicago. I think we can learn something about where these properties were located, the conditions, and the fact that these neighborhoods, many of which have been neglected, been abandoned by society and by policy that's created horrific situations and war zones in some cases, I think can tell us about where we've been and where we're going. And what makes it so exciting that some of these buildings actually still exist, it's physical evidence that it happened. And it's also an opportunity for us to go to a site of sanctuary and reflect on where we've been and where we are and what we can do about it. So I'm developing an exhibit that will hopefully travel. Smithsonian and I have had several conversations about it, and we'll see what happens. But this exhibit will be an opportunity to show Green Book sites, but also develop a virtual reality platform where you stand possibly in the situation of somebody driving through sundown town.
Well, that would be powerful.
Yeah, in the 1940s. And you get a sense of, you know, visceral experience of what that may have felt like. And then there will be a large wall-sized map that will look at all these layers of history. And it'll map sundown towns. It'll map Green Book sites, of course. It'll map incarceration rates and economic disparities, current KKK chapters. It'll be interactive. You can put in your zip code and see, maybe you were raised in a sundown town and didn't know it. Or maybe there's a KKK chapter in your community and you didn't know. It's important that we don't just say that this happened in the past and like, oh, thank God, we don't need that anymore. Because we still have a lot of problems. And we really need to look at how we can create some kind of interest in wanting to solve the problem and having some kind of agency around how to do that. And I believe there's power in proximity, as Bryan Stevenson says. When you go to certain neighborhoods that have been demonized, like South Central, and you realize that there are trees and kids and, you know, serenity, just like anywhere else in some areas of South Central. So I think people need to get out of their quote-unquote comfort zones and experience these places. And the fact that these Green Book sites are here, you get to do that. So the exhibit would be in a, maybe in a downtown or a city center, but there would be a walking tour through South Central because we have, about 30 Green Book sites within a two-mile radius. So I just think it's exciting that these sites are still standing.
What a pleasure to have you, particularly this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Candace Taylor. Get more information about her work on the Green Book on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we go to the other side of the world to take a look at jackfruit and Fijian cuisine. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Way out in the Pacific are the kinds of islands that make us dream or sing. Think the musical South Pacific. But all those islands ringed by water also yield some great food. Louis Tikaram is the head chef at EPNLP in West Hollywood, where he brings his Fijian, Chinese, and Indian roots to the table. So I detect from your accent Australia. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. Very short skip from Fiji. It's only about 3 hours. Not many people know that, you know, so it's really, really, really close. I just flew to New York last month, and that was six. I'm like, wow, could have flown Fiji and back again. So,
and I understand that growing up, you split your time between a 110-acre farm in Australia and your grandma's home in Fiji.
That's correct, yeah.
Tell me a bit about the farm.
The farm we moved to when we were quite young from Fiji. Mum and Dad back in the early 80s stumbled across a pretty magical town called Mullumbimby, which is in the northern New South Wales, almost on the border of Queensland and New South Wales and the most easterly point of Australia, which was Byron Bay. A short drive from Mullumbimby. Lots of banana farming and avocados and cattle. for what they were living in Sydney at the time. They could pretty much, you know, live out on this farm for next to nothing. So we packed the Datsun 180B and we drove up to Mullumbimby, and that's where we kind of set up shop. And we just lived in a little banana shed for the many years of my actual childhood. It used to be an old banana plantation. And there's this little shed with a big, great door that just opened in the front where the trucks would back up to and they'd pack the bananas. And that's where we lived. Mum and Dad had a bed in the living room and me and my brother were out the back and we had a bathtub and a little water heater. And yeah, that's all we really needed.
That sounds like paradise.
So just four of us. And yeah, from there, Dad just started to grow, very exotic kind of trees and Indian style of plants and things like that, like jabatikabars and wax jambus and acerolas and lots of native Australian produce as well, like kwandongs and things like this. It's funny, Noma came to Australia this year and Renee Redzepi was cooking all these Australian produce. Oh, yeah, I grew up with that. You know, this is what I was eating when I was a kid off the farms.
So acerola, I understand what that is because they add it to vitamin C.
It's very high in vitamin C. That's correct, yeah.
But what were those two previous things you said?
Jabatikabar. This is Indian, originally from India. It's a small fruit that actually grows on the trunks of trees. It's almost like a hardy bush grape. And you eat it and it's just full of this amazing, almost like artificial flavored fruit. You know, guavas and, you know, just there's the macadamia nuts and, yeah.
Growing up on the farm as you did, you must have grown up with just a ton of home cooking.
Yeah, everything out of the garden or off the farm, yeah, for sure.
And did you participate in that?
Yeah, me and my brother both have lots of chores. So it ranged from firewood and kindling and building the fire and doing the lawns on the weekend. But also there was a lot of cooking involved as well. That's how my father was brought up in Fiji. He had five brothers and sisters, so there's six of them in total, and one child would cook every night and grandma would cook on Sunday. I can't really decide who's the better chef. They all have their different signature dishes. My auntie Pat, she cooks very good star anise and ginger chicken. Auntie Anne's curries are the best. Uncle Jared's lovo's the best, so it's of lots of different styles.
Going back to Fiji, describe for us what a typical Fiji meal is. What are some of the staples?
A lot of seafood, a lot of root vegetables, what we call dalo, which is taro, and cassava, which is like the tapioca plant.
What do you do with the cassava?
We do it a couple of different ways. We'd either just boil it and just eat it like a potato, or we could make cassava fries as well, which was really nice. As a kid, that was my favorite. And it's so fibrous, so you'd boil it for a good amount of time, let it soften, and then flash fry it to order. And that's my favorite.
It's so interesting because you grew up in this environment in which the ingredients were sort of limited, but must have been incredible.
Yeah.
On the island.
Yeah.
I would imagine there was a lot of coconut as well.
Lots of coconut. So mum's about to go crazy. You know, the mangoes, star fruit, papaya. The papayas are just, you know, unbelievable. It's so humid and warm that things just grow so fast. So their garden over there is unbelievable, yeah.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to be a chef, that this was how you were going to earn your living?
When I was young, when I lived in Mullumbimby, the closest thing to home was a Thai restaurant. So I went in and I started washing dishes. That's how I got in the industry. And that's how I fell in love with Southeast Asian cooking as well. One day there was only a Thai woman and one chef, and that was all that was in the kitchen. And one day he didn't turn up. I jumped in, and from there I knew how to cook already. I cooked a lot with my grandma, I cooked a lot with my dad. So I came in, and within 6 months I had the keys to the restaurant. I'd come in, open it, turn some music on and start prepping straight after school. And it just kind of snowballed from there. I couldn't get enough of it. I just wanted to work every night after school. I wanted to work every weekend. And then I finished school. And while I was working, I was out one night and I met a guy in Byron Bay. And he said, you know, if you want to cook, Thai food, there's this restaurant in Sydney. It's called Long Grain. And so I packed up my car. I drove 12 hours. I got to Long Grain. Meanwhile, this restaurant, it was, the best new restaurant. Best wine list of the year, I think chef of the year. And I just rolled in. I didn't even have a uniform, didn't have knives. You know, I just used this woman's rinky-dink knives and I just rolled straight in. And I said, I want to talk to Martin. And they said, do you have a plan? I said, no, I'm just here to see him. And he came out and I said, oh, hi, I'm from Mullumbimby and I want to work here. And he was kind of like, oh, Jesus. I couldn't imagine what I look like, you know. And so he said, oh, I don't think so. I think, you know, we're good. And I said, oh, okay. So I just woke up the next day, went back in, talked to him again. And he said, no, geez, I told you yesterday. All right.
How long did it take?
The third day, I rocked back in. And this is when I didn't know what I was going to do. And I went back in and I asked him and he said, okay, let's go. And he put me in the back and I made curry paste and grind spices and things like that for about a year. He bought me my first set of knives, bought me my chef's jacket. And I never really looked back from there.
The food that you make now at EP and LP, it's a combination of all these different influences.
Yeah, absolutely. My grandmother was Fijian Chinese. My grandfather was Fijian Indian. And I fell in love with Thai cooking.
I understand that there was an Indian migration to the islands.
Absolutely, yeah.
That influenced the cuisine.
Yeah. People ask me, you know, what is, you know, apart from the real traditional Fijian, which is lots of, we call it a lovo. It's where you cook under the ground. So we heat up hot river rocks. We wait till they smolder down into a pit. We marinate in garlic and onion and we wrap it in banana leaves and we pop it in the pit. Then we fill the soil back over. And then it takes about 4 hours and you open it up and it's all earthy, beautifully slow-cooked meat. And that's traditional Fijian style of cuisine. The Indian, they came and they brought all their beautiful dried spices and masalas and things like this. So Fijian is really cool. We use a lot of coconut. So I almost describe the modern Fijian cuisine and almost being kind of like Malaysian, where it's lots of the Fijian influences like seaweeds and coconut and seafood mixed with the kind of dry spices of Indian. So you never really would have known what was going to be on the dinner table. Could have been Indian, could have been Chinese, could have been Fijian.
Do you use any of the Fijian techniques in your cooking now?
Absolutely, yes. So I have a really couple of amazing dishes on the menu at EP. One is probably the earliest dish I ever cooked with my grandmother, which is called nama. And the nama is the sea pearls, which is a type of seaweed that we used to buy, or we used to get them from the river. And that's just really simply served with fresh squeezed coconut cream and some aromats like red shallots and some chili and lime juice and seasoned just with salt.
A seaweed ceviche.
Exactly. I think if I, you know, put it in Australia, it'd be popular, it'd be nice. But because I brought it to LA where there's so many vegans and vegetarians, it kind of took off because normally vegans and veggies, they don't have anything to eat at the start of the meal. You know, everyone else is having sashimi and ceviche and things like that and oysters. This dish is just perfect.
Another tropical fruit that people are talking a lot about in the vegan community is jackfruit.
Oh, yeah. Jackfruit here, they're usually picked quite green, quite unripe down in Mexico. So I actually need them in the restaurant. I probably have them for 1 to 2 weeks maybe to ripen up, and you can tell by the aroma really starts to smell when they're ripe. So I have them actually along the chef's counter most days. So if people are interested in what a jackfruit looks like, they're usually on the chef's counter ripening. Yeah, but it's an amazing fruit. It's one of those fruits that I ate when I was a young kid. In Fiji, we actually eat it green and we actually make a savory curry out of it green. So it's very labor intensive. You crack it open when it's green, then you pick, and it's almost just like thousands and thousands of millions of little fibers you pick, and then you mix it with a dry spice and you just cook it slightly, and it's beautiful. It's the most amazing curry. You can tell how much work has gone into it. But then cooking Thai, it was ripe and we always just used it in dessert. So it's kind of cool seeing both ways.
So I'm at EP and LP for the first time. Maybe I'm at EP. Because I understand that there's all these different levels, right?
The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, the Da Vinci Code of restaurants. But I'm there to eat dinner. Tell me three things on the menu I'm going to have.
I think you definitely should have either the nama or the kakonda. So the kakonda is similar to the nama, but with Baja rock shrimp. It's excellent. It's zingy. It's zesty. It really gets your palate going. I think definitely you'd have to, the menu set out so you order very balanced. And I think, you know, I always have a nice salad item in the meal. So I've got a beautiful wood grilled octopus with Asian pear, farmer market greens, and ginger and black bean. And I think that's nice in the middle. For the end, I don't think you can really go past the crispy skin chicken. This is one that's traveled with me from Australia. It's one of my faves. It's a master stock crispy skin chicken with black vinegar and roast chili and five spice and lemon.
And the Chinese comes in
here. The Chinese comes out. This is, yeah, definitely one of my grandma's smash hits. So, yeah, that's a favorite of mine.
Since the restaurant's called EP and LP, do you have a playlist you'd like to share with us?
Oh, I play pretty much everything West Coast hip-hop from the early 90s, late 80s.
Give me a couple of songs.
Check Yourself from Ice Cube, pretty much all of the Doggy Style, Dre, The Chronic. What else has been on lately? Even some new stuff like Kendrick Lamar and the new Dr. Dre as well we play. So, yeah, anything kind of hip-hop.
Louis Tikaram is head chef at EP and LP in West Hollywood. Get a recipe for his kokoda, that's ceviche Fiji style, on the Good Food blog. Now it's time for the market report. Let's see what Laura's shopping for in Santa Monica this week.
This is Laura Avery with the market report. Summer is officially upon us when we start seeing lots and lots of peppers at the farmers market. And I am talking right now with Ted Hobson, who is the chef owner of the Bellwether in Studio City. And Ted, you're here today and you're telling us you're getting a lot of peppers. Let's talk about what kind of peppers you're getting.
I grew up kind of eating out of the backyard. My grandmother had a huge garden and it was always peppers, tons of every kind of pepper from spicy to mild. And so for me, that's really one of the great summertime things. I think people don't really fully utilize them because they get scared of like heat. Like everyone thinks pepper is a chili, it's spicy. I want to avoid that because I don't like spicy. But the truth is there's a lot more to it than that. And so like right now, you could find all varieties of bell peppers, which are sweet, right? But they have purple, red, green, everything's out there. Shishito peppers, which I love. They have both green and red here today.
Let's talk about what they look like.
A shishito pepper is like about a 2-inch chili. It's very close to a padrone pepper, which is like the Spanish relative. And in Italy, very close to the same pepper they use to pickle and make what we know as pepperoncinis, the ones in the jar. All kind of same vein of pepper chili.
And very wrinkly.
Very wrinkly, yeah, yeah. I like to use them raw because they have a really good, like, grassy flavor. Also, right now, there's cayenne peppers. I was talking to my cousin was here with me today about, you know, everyone
See
uses...
the hot one with the beard?
Yeah, he's a tall, skinny version of me, just hotter. Anyway, everyone uses cayenne pepper in recipes. Like, it's one of the most common, like, dried spices there is. Well, there's actually fresh cayenne peppers here today, which is something you just don't see often.
Describe what that looks like.
It's like a small green pepper. It's got a little curve to it. So it's probably, the pepper's about 5 inches. It's very skinny, like maybe a quarter inch to a half inch thick, but it is hot. And usually when you get the spice, it's dried out. So it turns red and then ground. So using them fresh, you get more of that like grassy kind of fresh chili flavor, less of that just pure heat flavor. There's red Fresnos here. They're not hot, hot. They're kind of more in the medium zone. Great flavor. And for us here in California, they grow pretty well. You know, if you go to New York, those peppers are 10 times the price because they just can't grow them there. So it's one of the things that, you know, when I talk about produce with my chef friends throughout the whole nation, everyone's always jealous of what we have here. We get red Fresnos. They're in season right now. I could buy them at the local market and they're amazing.
And I think a lot of people know about the Hatch chilies, and you see sometimes the roasters set up on the side of the road. We have something that I think is exactly the same thing, which is an Anaheim.
Yeah, that's one of the peppers like I grew up on. They're so good. So we would fire roast them, peel them, and then submerge them in olive oil with garlic and cherry tomatoes. Because like I'm Italian, that's what we did. And we would just eat it with bread. And so for us, that's like the summertime staple. My wife still every summer is like, make the peppers, make the peppers.
Okay, so with all these chilies, what are you going to be doing for a dish?
We do a Korean beef tartare. So we make a homemade samjang, mix it together, and then garnish it with a whole bunch of different chilies, both pickled and raw, and other vegetables too. Like we use stems of lettuce, little cabbage, radish, fresh bell pepper, pickled peppers, pickled Fresnos, fresh raw shishitos. All of them just sliced thin, and we just garnish them on top of the beef tartare because as you eat it, you get the sweetness from the chilies, the vinegar from the pickled ones, some spiciness, some of the freshness, the crunch. It has everything you want. So texture, flavor, heat, all of it's there. And the crunch of it acts as a great vehicle to eat the raw beef with that kind of crunchy, fresh component for like this, you know, samjang is like a fermented paste. So you kind of get that fermented aged flavor with this super fresh vegetable component. It just makes a really beautiful union together.
And how do you get the peels off?
I'm old school Italian, so we do the old thing is we grill them on the grill and then put them in a brown paper bag, close the bag. It lets them steam out, but also picks up some of the extra moisture. So you just do that and let them sit for a little bit until they're cool enough to handle, and they peel off super easy.
Right, and I've heard if you wash it off with water, does that take away some of the flavor?
Yeah, we don't wash with water. For me, like, the less you do to food, sometimes the better it could be. So, you know, why wash it with water? Like, some people are worried that maybe a seed or two gets through, but that could be beautiful. I mean, a few seeds in there never hurt anybody. You know, it's how our parents all ate, right? They didn't perfect everything. It was the imperfection of it that made it so glorious, you know?
That was Ted Hobson. He is the chef owner of The Bellwether in Studio City. They've been open about 11 months, and we love him because he loves the market. One of the pepper growers that Ted was just talking about is Florabella Farm from Three Rivers. And Florabella is a certified CCOF, certified organic farm. And right now I'm talking to Mike Handley. Now, Mike, you've got a beautiful display of shishito peppers. They go from green to red. So can you tell us a little bit about how you guys grow them up there, and do they just all turn red eventually?
Yeah, we grow them in a tall house, which is an open greenhouse, and they do eventually mature to red. The greener ones will have the more nutty flavor when they're roasted up, and the red ones have a sweeter flavor.
Okay, when you say a tall house, does the height help to prevent certain things happen that happen in lower hoop houses?
Yeah, I believe the tall house is so there's more cool air in it. So the hot air goes all the way to the top, and then it's not as hot.
The shishitos are very small. They seem to always be the same size, so they don't keep getting bigger and bigger on the vine, or do you just pick them at this size?
We're picking them all season long. The goal was this year to have them all the way throughout the summer, and they're a really neat pepper. We call them a Russian roulette, where one is hot out of maybe 10 or 15, so it's an exciting thing to cook.
No way to tell which is the hot one.
Right, you really can't tell, but as the season goes on, so later in the season, there'll be more hot ones.
Is this something that's kind of become recently more popular?
It seems like they're getting more and more popular as we're having them and people are trying them.
Do you save the seeds and then plant your own? How do you replant every year?
I believe that everything on the farm starts from seed and then goes into a greenhouse, and the little seedlings will start in the greenhouse and then go out to the field.
And I know that you have a lot of wild animals up there. You've got wild boar, and you've got deer, and you've got all kinds of stuff. And I know James once said he figures 25% of his crop is going to go to the animals. But they don't get in the greenhouse, do they?
No, not too much. And this is the first year there's a deer fence set up. So there's much less deer and bear on the farm this year.
All bears.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right up there in the foothill of the Sequoia National Park. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, we're at about 1,000-foot elevation, and it's all fed by river water, which is all snow melt, which was snow a couple days ago and then comes down, and we irrigate with that.
And you have some good water this year?
Yeah, there's a lot more water this year. The snowpack is much bigger because of El Nino. Mm-hmm. We had some late storms and some late cold that kind of froze the pack a little bit more.
Okay, well, good. All right, Mike. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Mike Handley. He works up on Florabella Farm in Three Rivers, certified organic farm at the foothills of the Sierras. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find the Bellwether's recipe for Samjiang beef tartare on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. We've got more Good Food coming up in 1 minute. Stay close.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Earlier this year, Good Food devoted an entire episode to seafood. After our broadcast, the Associated Press team, who reported on seafood from slaves, went on to win the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. The horrors they exposed of slave labor in the Thai seafood industry isn't going to leave us anytime soon. The responsibility falls on us, the consumer, to be mindful of where our food comes from and the sacrifices made as it finds its way to our tables. Dominique Barnes and Michelle Wolf are founders of a startup called New Wave Foods. They're developing synthetic shrimp that have never wiggled through an ocean. Olga Khazan covered the company and its mission for The Atlantic. I don't know why this seems odder to me than fake chicken or fake beef, but somehow it does. What is the shrimp produced by New Wave Foods made from?
Kind of their secret ingredient is red algae, which is the food that shrimp eat that give them their pinkish color. And they're also using a bunch of different plant-based proteins, too.
This red algae, is it giving the shrimp more than its color? Or are they primarily relying on it also to give flavor?
I think it's both color and flavor. I think because the shrimp eat it, it tastes a little bit like what they eat. And it's also kind of the texture. It has a little bit of a kind of that spongy, bouncy texture that cooked shrimp have.
Yeah, because it seems to me that more than other animal proteins, trying to synthesize shrimp, it's so much about that bouncy texture.
Yeah, and they really want it to be almost indistinguishable from the real thing, which is a really tall order for something that people are so familiar with. It's sort of a texture and flavor that people know and love really well.
Is the process the same or different from other synthetic proteins like lab-cultured meat?
It is pretty different from lab-cultured meat. Lab-cultured meat is actually grown from cow stem cells in a petri dish in a lab. So this product doesn't actually involve any actual shrimp cells. It's more kind of like tofurkey than it is like a lab-grown meat. If you're kosher or vegetarian or vegan, you could eat it without worrying about breaking your dietary restrictions.
Is it similar to the process of creating fake crab?
No, fake crab actually, Dominique called that fish bologna because I guess the fake crab actually uses different types of fish and parts of fish. They all get mashed together into what's called crab stick and then kind of dyed. So that's also a different thing because that's actually made of fish as well, but this isn't.
The process, I understand, has been described as being similar to baking bread.
Yeah, it's proprietary. So as is typical with Silicon Valley, she wouldn't get into many details about her proprietary process. But she said it's very similar to cooking, and actually up to and including the fact that they apply heat to the different ingredients of it at different times in order to essentially cook up this shrimp product.
The thing that's fascinating to me about shrimp is if you look at it, it's not just pink. Like chicken is sort of this bland sort of ochre color, or meat is different shades of like red to brown. It has like striations on it and tiny little black dots. Are they going to be like laser printed?
That's a really good question. I think that's probably why they're starting with a breaded popcorn shrimp, because they might have trouble kind of initially getting it to look exactly like a real shrimp. So they're covering it in the breading, which I guess is a really popular way that Americans like to eat shrimp. Right now, she said she's working on figuring out how to make it look enough like real shrimp so she could actually have fake cocktail shrimp that people can eat, you know, in a shrimp cocktail that looks exactly like the real thing.
How far off are they from launching this popcorn shrimp?
They said they're about 6 to 12 months away and that they'll probably soft launch on the West Coast first. So lucky you guys.
Yeah, because we're so open to all these weird things.
Right, exactly. You're not like us DC people. So it'll probably be a little bit closer to the 6 months for you guys. We'll have to wait the full year. They're working on the cocktail shrimp right now, but they don't know when that's going to launch yet.
Are they also working on other products?
No, she's all shrimp all the time right now, you know, because it's shrimp is the most popular seafood, I guess, among Americans. So that's the thing she wanted to tackle.
So these plant-based proteins that have hit the market in the last couple of years haven't exactly been a hit with customers. Personally, I'd rather eat chickpeas out of a can, since that's kind of what a lot of the stuff tastes like to me. How is the company going about sort of honing taste? Do they have professional tasters?
I don't know about professional tasters. They might have some sort of advisors or someone who helps them with that. I know they started in a really scrappy little startup incubator in San Francisco, where it's all these different bio startups kind of working side by side at these lab benches. And they were, you know, cooking up their little shrimp and serving them to like the other entrepreneurs in this incubator. So in a sense, they had their test audience sort of captive and hungry and free. A lot of the analysts that I talked to for this, they talked about how if you tell people that there's algae in their food or that's what their food is mostly made of, they're not going to be very excited by that and they might be sort of put off. So that is sort of a issue for them that they're going to have to tackle.
That's so interesting to me, because if you look at a vegan audience, which I would imagine is going to be the first wave of consumers that they try and break through with, they're very open to eating ocean-based greens.
Yeah, and actually, even people who aren't necessarily vegan are already eating things like algae and seaweed, because two really common forms of food additives, carrageenan and agar, are based on those. You know, it's not in big, bold letters on the front of your yogurt cup that it has seaweed in it. So I think a lot of people just might not know, and I think they'll probably try to downplay that as well.
How much of the inspiration for doing this was a way to go around the very, very long-term, if possible, reforms that the shrimping industry is going to have to go through to get rid of the slaving issue?
This one's a little bit trickier to parse. She said she was concerned about the slavery issue in the shrimp industry, but all of that sort of came onto the scene as they were already thinking about this product. You know, it sort of became part of these investigations and things as they were already thinking about this product. So I don't know that she was totally motivated by the shrimp industry abuses. She is a marine biologist by training, and she, I think, is concerned about all the sustainability issues with all different types of seafood and the ecosystems where, you know, fish come from and all of that stuff, you know, water pollution, everything, overfishing she talked about. So I think she's just concerned about a lot of different issues to do with fish and wanted to sort of take on one particular seafood product first.
Well, it definitely seems like that's a much broader angle to market to consumers than just the fact that it's vegan.
Yeah, and actually, one thing she told me was that she is somewhat pursuing the kosher angle as well, because they don't contain any shellfish materials. So people who keep kosher but might want to try shrimp or enjoy shrimp can have these. And she's working with two different rabbis on a kosher certification right now.
Did you get to eat any?
No, I unfortunately didn't get to try any because she didn't have any with her when I saw her.
That just seems just not fair.
I know. I really wanted to because I really like shrimp. So
that's the problem, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I understand that this incubator that she was a part of is sort of a hotbed of synthetic food startups.
Yeah. And not just in that incubator, but this is really an area where we're seeing a lot of kind of cool and interesting ideas right now. So we've got the fake shrimp. We've got a fake burger. There's also now fake eggs made from plant proteins for people who are vegan. And there's actually also a fake milk called Moo Free, which is really crazy. It involves inserting DNA sequences from cattle into yeast cells and growing the cultures and then harvesting the milk proteins and mixing them with, like, calcium and different sugars and things.
So they actually are trying to replicate a synthetic milk.
That one is more similar to real milk than I would say this new wave product is similar to real shrimp.
Is a lot of the synthetic proteins that are being worked on now based on work that Hampton Creek has been doing?
So the fake eggs are Hampton Creek, and of course they have the fake mayonnaise. I keep saying fake, and I mean that as a stand-in for the traditional kind of option, not as a pejorative thing. The fake eggs are Hampton Creek, and so is the fake mayonnaise. But, you know, some of these are just kind of individual little scrappy startups, sometimes just one or two people kind of working with a test tube and kind of seeing what they can do.
So there, I would imagine, given that so many of these little companies are looking for hedge fund investors, that there isn't a lot of sharing of resources.
I think it depends. At the incubator, that is really a shared kind of resource because they all have access to the same mentors and, you know, the same space and, you know, bounce ideas off each other. Some of them are in competition with one another. But then again, some of these, you know, Silicon Valley investors, they invest in a lot of different things that are similar to one another sometimes. I think Peter Thiel might be someone who's interested in this whole space.
And he is?
Oh, he's the founder of PayPal.
It's kind of like looking at a roulette table. You got to spread your bets around.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, it's such a people are more and more interested in healthy options and sort of gluten-free and, you know, almond milk and all those things. So this is all sort of an outgrowth of that.
Wow, so interesting. Once it gets released to the public, assuming that it's a product that, if not absolutely delicious, is a pretty good substitute, would you reach for a synthesized shrimp?
I think I actually would because I eat all this stuff. Like I do the seitan and the veggie burgers and all of that, even though I'm a Texan and that's sacrilege. And I think a lot of people would too. I mean, a lot of the analysts that I spoke with said that if they're price competitive, a lot of people end up picking the sort of sustainable option.
Really, really interesting. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Olga Hazan is a staff writer for The Atlantic, where we found her article on New Wave Foods. We close out the show on Sunset Boulevard with a recommendation for foie gras mousse and popcorn ice cream. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. And you can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
For desserts, the thing I like the best is probably the thing you'd assume I would like the best, which is homemade ice cream that's flavored with popcorn.
That's our own Jonathan Gold talking about Paley in Hollywood.
And, you know, they top it with, you know, sprinkles of brown buttered solids.
So they make popcorn and they infuse it in the milk.
Right.
Oh, I bet that's good.
It is. It's, you know how I am with salty desserts, and this is a really nice salty dessert.
So this restaurant is in Columbia House, right?
It is in the Columbia Square complex, which has been the Columbia Square complex since the 30s, when it was the first sort of headquarters of CBS radio. A lot of the famous old-time radio shows came from out of there. And the first years of CBS television before it moved to Television City near Farmers Market.
Ergo the name, Paley.
Correct. In Los Angeles, people are fond of naming landmarks after things that aren't there anymore.
I understand that getting to this restaurant is a bit of a fraught experience.
It can be. The last time I went, there's valet parking, but the valet parkers for some reason didn't want to do it. Maybe it was late in the evening. Maybe they looked at my dented truck. I don't know. But they sort of like waved me down a wrong way corridor, which took some strange turns, and I ended up in a totally empty parking lot. I finally found an elevator, and I ended up like on a fairly high floor of a completely unfinished office building with girders and plaster dust and things. I felt like something out of one of those, you know, alienated French films of the early 60s, you know, something by Jacques Tati or even Alphaville.
Oh, I don't know. We're veering to a disturbing area. Who's the chef and what kind of food are we eating?
The chef is Greg Bernhardt, who has been around forever. He opened Church and State. He worked at a lot of the Ludo Lefebvre, Ludo Bites pop-ups. I think he did Perch, you know, the restaurant / bar downtown.
And how would you describe his food?
Bernhardt is good with fire. There's a lot of things that are smoked. There are things that are cooked directly on coals. There's a lot of coal and wood language on the menu. He likes to work a lot with raw fish, as is the custom in Los Angeles at the moment. It's not a vegetable-intensive menu, but there are vegetables in everything. One of the best dishes probably is the coal-charred carrots.
Coal-charred carrots.
Right. They're just sort of slightly burnt carrots that come with an herb paste.
That sounds pretty good. I've noticed that the menu also hosts some words that seem kind of, quote, retro, words like mousse, and that there's a pasta with vodka cream.
The pasta with vodka cream is new. There's some caviar sprinkled on top. They say it was a special at Le Dome, you know, one of the old-time restaurants on the Sunset Strip. I don't actually remember that particular pasta, but I'm sure it was. They do an appetizer. It's a big plate of mussels that are cooked with a little bit of gin, vermouth, and pickled onions to give it the flavors of a martini, supposedly.
Does that work?
If somebody didn't tell you they were the flavors of a martini, you wouldn't know it. But it doesn't not work. I mean, mussels steamed in vermouth with pickled onions turn out to be pretty good.
What else did you enjoy as a starter?
They have a plateau, I guess. is what they call it. And when I hear the word plateau, I imagine one of those, you know, massive wedding cake tiered seafood platters like we get at Le Dome in Paris. This is one plate. There's a lot of ice involved. And it's pretty much all of the seafood appetizers combined into one combination. So there's like oysters with sort of a soy vinaigrette. There's shrimp cocktail. There's scallop sliced very thin with those little crunchy beads of finger lime. And it's draped over some rice melon. And there's a little bit of tartness from lemon verbena. It's a nice fragrant dish.
That sounds like a nice, very Southern California way to start the meal.
Yeah, or have it be the meal. You know, come late at night, have a martini, have that. This isn't a place for hearty eaters probably anyway, but when you get it, you look like you're getting something that's baller, and sometimes that's important.
Especially in Hollywood.
Especially in Hollywood. The beef tartare is flavored with gochujang, so it looks super, super bloody before you taste and you realize that there's chili paste in with the mean.
I don't think I've ever had beef tartare like that.
I don't think I have either. And I've had a lot of beef tartare lately.
Is it a thing?
I would say it is officially a thing. And also a thing, though they don't have it here, is beet tartare. But we'll talk about that soon enough.
That's true.
Some of my favorite stuff at the restaurant is on the snack menu, which is bite size, like a little thing of foie gras mousse. There's your mousse, which is, you know, very airy and nice. And it's sort of like paved with shaved plums and flowers or whatever's in season. There's a smoked chicken liver pate that's very livery, but it's nice. The smoke just comes through. Maybe this isn't the best value anybody's ever seen on a menu, but they do these things with like little slivers, like the size of dominoes, that are of A5 Wagyu beef that are cooked over coals. That's, you know, the same way that you've seen albacore in Japanese restaurants. The outside is seared and the inside is essentially raw, and it's flavored with a little bit of soy and honey, and it's delicious.
And rich.
So rich.
What about the mains?
The mains almost seem like an afterthought. I mean, as they do in restaurants like that. But the, you know, the grilled duck breast is properly crunchy where it should be crunchy, and it's served on a puree of umeboshi, the Japanese plums. And the tartness goes with the duck really nicely. And I also like the wild rice, which is just wild rice, but you don't see it that often. It's nicely cooked. It has that slight gaminess, a beautiful crunch, a little chewiness, and it comes with some, you know, cabbage and string beans. Simple dish.
That's the vegetarian main. It sounds delicious.
These days, sometimes a vegetarian main is better than the one that has a giant slab of meat.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Paley in Hollywood. Text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations. Well, that's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can always listen whenever you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also podcast it on demand on KCRW's mobile app and any other podcasting app out there. So many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress Swanson, Laryl Garcia, Camelia Say, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Masiha, and Pete Bloomberg. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food. P.S. You can now register for KCRW's pie contest. It's scheduled to be on October 2nd. Get the details at kcrw.com/pie.